Hebrews chapter 3. We got through the first six verses last Wednesday. We're going to get through the rest of chapter 3 hopefully tonight and start on chapter 4 next Wednesday. Well, probably not next Wednesday, depending on who's teaching class while I'm gone and what they're going to teach, but we'll be on next class will be chapter 4. I've got the chapter 4 handouts up here, so if you didn't get one, come to me after class or I'll come to you. I think I know who hasn't got them and who has got them. Okay, in chapter 3 in the first six verses, what did we talk about the last meeting? Jesus' superiority to Moses. And what specifically makes him superior to Moses? Servant of the house. Jesus was the son. He's God. Says that he who built the house has more honor than the house. And every house is built by someone. He who built all things is God. And so that makes that implication that Jesus is God. Of course, that's been made in the first chapter. And so we know that he's superior to the old covenant, to the prophets, to the angels, to Moses, because he is God. And he is the son of God, the one who made the house. And he's not just a servant of the house. So what is the house? What did we say the house was? The children, the people, the church is the house we're in now. The house then was the children of Israel, the Israelites, the chosen people of God. And so in verse 6 it says, Christ as a son over his house, whose house we are, if we hold fast the confidence and the rejoicing of the hope firm to an end. We talked about this and what that meant, and Rodney mentioned it. So what does that mean? What significance do we hold to that? And we're about to get into it even deeper in the next verses. That house, if we hold fast, that we can do what? Apostatize, fall away. Rodney mentioned that last time, that's not just saying that we have a hope of heaven if we're in this house, but it's saying that if you don't hold fast to the end and are firm to the end, then we don't have that hope. We're not a part of that house. We're not a part of that promise of entering in that land of rest, which we're going to get into a little bit now. So through verses 7 through the end of the chapter, we start building upon this idea that we have to hold fast, that this is if we hold fast, if we are firm to the confidence that we have and we hold firm to the faith, that object of faith and obedience to God, then we can enter in that rest. If not, we can fall away. And we see the comparison of the old and new covenants and that the new is better than the old. But along with this, the comparison is being made for the purpose of showing these people that are falling away and turning back to this old covenant and this old way of living under that old covenant, that what they're doing is wrong. They're departing from the faith. And so the apostasy is seen throughout the book of Hebrews, and especially here in the third chapter that we're about to talk about now. So chapter 3, beginning verse 7, says, therefore, as the Holy Spirit says, today if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion, in the day of trial in the wilderness, where your fathers tested me, tried me, and saw my works 40 years. Therefore I was angry with that generation and said, they always go astray in their heart, and they have not known my ways. So I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. But exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end, while it is said, today if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. For who, having heard, rebelled? Indeed, was it not all who came out of Egypt led by Moses? Now with whom was he angry for 40 years? Was it not those who sinned, whose corpses fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who did not obey? So we see that they could not enter in because of unbelief. So that putting all those together and seeing the broad point that's being made, the main point is that he says, take heed, this is, you can only enter this rest if we hold fast. You can only be a part of this house if you hold fast. And then he gives the example of the Israelites and how they were not able to enter into that land of rest, that Canaan land, because of their unbelief. And we'll talk about what that means. This therefore here, obviously, as I just said, is there because he said, we are of that house if we hold fast. And that's kind of ominous when you think about it. If we hold fast, there is a possibility of falling away. And so he's warning them in this way. And he says, therefore, because of this, I'll give you an example of this. And he says, today, if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the day of rebellion and the trial in the wilderness. This is taken from the 95th Psalm and verses 7 through 11. And it's talking about the children of Israel. It says, as in the day of the rebellion. What is the rebellion? What's he talking about here?
The children of Israel rebelled against him often. You could pick any number of instances, but they complained and rebelled all the time. And especially when they come to Mount Sinai, Moses went up and they were even talking about going back to Egypt, made a golden calf.
Exactly. You go over to Exodus 17th chapter, and see one of the examples of this. After they've been led out of Egypt and they're not in captivity anymore, he's shown them his mighty works and the plagues. He's crossed the Red Sea and parted it, and now they've just been given manna rain down from heaven, and they're getting provided for, and they still question God. In Exodus 17, and beginning in verse 7. We see here it says, all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped in Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people contended with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. So Moses said to them, why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord? And just keep in mind here that they had just been given in chapter 16, just before in verse 31, that the house of Israel called its name manna. They were just given manna from heaven. They were provided for, and now they're complaining about something else. And in verse 3 he says, the people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses and said, why is it you have brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, what shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me. And the Lord said to Moses, go on before the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel. Also take in your hand your rod, which you struck the river, and go, behold, I will stand before you there on the rock in Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. So he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah, because the contention of the children of Israel, and because they tempted the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" And so, and if you remember here, it tells Moses to strike the rock, and he does so. Later on, he'll tell Moses to speak to the rock. And either Moses wasn't paying attention, he thought it was the same before, or just he was caught up in the moment and he struck the rock. And that's when he's not able to enter the promised land. But we see the rebellion here. And we see it several times before. Like Randy said, this wasn't just a one-time thing. In fact, in that excerpt from, quote from Psalm 95, he says that they always go astray in their heart. And it's not saying it's a continuous action that they've always been and always will be. It's saying they keep revisiting this. They were happy when they were delivered from the Egyptians. Then they come to the Red Sea. Pharaoh's coming up behind them. And what do? They question God. They doubt him. They ask, why did you bring us out of Egypt to die? Why couldn't we stay in Egypt and be a slave there and work there? And go through what we've been going through. And then they cross the river or the sea. And then it happens again and it happens again. And it happens several times after that. This is just one of the examples of this. It says they called the place Massah and Meribah. These two things mean testing and rebellion. And so this is why they named it that place. Because it was a place where they tested God. They rebelled against him. They questioned him. They were not faithful. Going back to Hebrews, it says, do not harden your hearts as in the days of the rebellion. What does harden your hearts mean? What does that mean? Remember, Pharaoh's heart was hardened.
Usually it's an idea of setting your will against God. I mean, this case it is. They've already determined to do something, and they don't care what God thinks or not. Basically said, I'm doing my way, which I don't really understand. These people were slaves for 400 years. They were told what to do, what to eat, they were trying to everything. Where did they develop this attitude of grumbling and griping? And especially, I don't understand that, because you know they didn't do that with the Egyptians. Not being slaves, they pretty much were told everything to do. But anyway, they just hardened it. Some reason between now and then, they decided to do things their own way. They didn't care what God and Moses said.
Exactly. It's hardening your heart is knowing the commandments of God, and there's no excuse, and you know that's the right way to go, but you know sin looks better. And in this case, complaining looks better. Looking back to Egypt, looking in the past looks better. And because of this, they harden their hearts. When we harden our hearts, it's because we choose to sin, we want to sin. We know it's wrong, but we choose to sin. We're hardening our hearts, and when we do that, we have a fear, or there is a fear, there is a possibility of falling away. It says, where your fathers tested me, tried me, and saw my works for 40 years. So that testing and trying him, they even questioned if he was there with them after they had just received manna and rain from heaven, this stuff they've never had before. And it was great and obviously from God. And they questioned if he was even with them. It says that they saw his works for 40 years. The actual Greek of this, it leaves out the me. It says, where your fathers tested me. And they put that in to show the subject that tested God, me. But if you take those out, and I read this in a commentary, I don't really get why he would say this, because it makes sense. Where your fathers tested me, tried me, and saw my works 40 years. It says, where your fathers tested, tried, and saw my works. And so that puts it on the works. They tested the works, tried the works. And I think the significance of this and what it's meaning is that they're testing God, they're trying him, even though they're seeing his works. You have that today in Romans, and we'll make mention of this later. In Romans, they have no excuse. It is without excuse. They know God exists. They see the creation, and it's manifest in the creation. And instead of obeying him because they know he exists and demands our obedience, they're going to harden their hearts and fall away and choose to sin. And so people want to believe if they see a miracle, if they saw someone come back from the dead. Mentioned it in my sermon last Sunday in Luke 16, the rich man and Lazarus, how he said, just send Lazarus from the dead to my family and they're going to repent. They're going to obey you. And he said, no, they have Moses and the prophets. If they don't hear them and believe them and obey them or obey me through them, then they're not going to change if they see someone raised from the dead. So they're testing him, and even though they saw his works, all the miracles that were performed, every way he provided for them, and they still tested him and they still questioned him. It says, therefore, I was angry with them in that generation and said, they always go astray in their heart and they have not known my ways. So I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. So he's angry with them because they're testing him. And we remember that he said they shall not enter. If we go to Numbers 14 chapter in verse 29, we see the record of this, and he says in verse 29 of Numbers 14, the carcasses of you who have complained against me shall fall in this wilderness, all of you who are numbered according to your entire number from 20 years old and above. And so they're not going to enter this rest. Do we remember really what led to this, the act that led to them wandering in the wilderness? What happened?
Well, went in, and 10 said they couldn't take it, and 2, Joshua and Caleb said they did. So everybody ended up dying except Joshua and Caleb, that was above, I believe, 18 years old, that went into the promised land. They were the only 2 old guys that went.
Right. So they were, talk about unbelief. They didn't believe that they were going to be able to conquer this land. And Joshua 1, he tells Joshua, I'm going to be with you. Be strong and courageous. As long as you have my law in your mind and your heart and you're speaking this, not letting it depart from your being, then I'm going to be with you. You should be strong and courageous. And no matter how testing it looks, it's going to happen. You're going to fulfill taking over this land. And whenever they were in darkness, they had sin in the camp. Like when they went and tried to destroy Ai the first time, they were defeated because there was sin in the camp. Achan took of the accursed things, and then as soon as they purged that, now they're back in the sight of God, and he tells them, I'm giving this land into your hands. And that's what he was telling them. I'm going to give you Canaan. And then they doubted because of what the spies brought back. And so because of that, they were not able to enter in that rest. It says that they have not known my ways. What's that mean? Because they've been with him. They've been given the law. So how do they not know his ways?
They don't trust him.
Okay, they don't trust him. They have all these commandments to obey. They understand that they need to obey them. And they don't, but they know them. How does it... What I'm getting is that they don't know him because he's given them this commandment. He expects them to obey it. And we talked about reverence last week, about we are to revere him because he is God. And without reverence in those commands, without fearing him because of this, without respecting and being cognizant of his nature and obeying him because of that, and having a respect and a fear for him and that reverence, then you don't know his ways. You're not acting like you know his ways. You don't act like you should act in the presence of God. And this was part of their unbelief and the fact that they didn't know his ways. So he swore in his wrath that they shall not enter his rest. Any questions about that excerpt from Psalm 95? Yeah, Psalm 95. Questions or comments? Okay, so why did he give this example again?
I'm doing all talking.
That's fine. If you, no one else wants to talk, that's okay.
Well, because I think if we, I know a lot of times it's, we sit back and think about the children of Israel, and if I'd been there and I'd seen this and I'd seen that, there's no way that I would have done what they did. And to be honest with myself, I'd probably would be. It's kind of hard for me to say that because I think we have that same that we can put ourselves in their situation today. We have God's word. We've seen. We have the whole book in front of us, and yet we choose to harden our hearts and to turn from God. I think he's warning them just like they did back in the old days.
Exactly.
You can simply do it. It will happen to you today, and it's relevant then, and it's relevant to us now that we do the same thing.
Right. We're not above them. If anything, we're to look at each other and esteem each other higher than ourselves. And so someone falls away in sin in the church, you don't look upon them like I'm better than you. If I were in that situation, I wouldn't have done it. And it's the same here. Looking back at the Israelites, maybe some of them thought that if they were in that place now that they wouldn't sin or they wouldn't have done that. We look at it now back into the New the first century church and even back to the Israelites and think the same things. He's getting the point across is that no one's greater than this. Take heed lest you fall. And he gives this example here. Also, we can go back to the first few verses of chapter 2. And he says that if every transgression and disobedience received a just reward under this old covenant, how much more are you going to be punished under this new covenant where you've been spoken to by the Son and it's been followed by miracles, signs, and wonders and confirmed in this way. And it's such a better covenant and it's the way you're going to get into heaven. And how much more are you going to be punished under this new law if they were punished under this old law? And that brings us to the idea of this land of rest. We said the land of rest then with the Israelites was what? The Canaan land. So what is that to us when we reference that? Heaven. You talk about the type, anti-type relationships. The types in the Old Testament, in the Old Covenant, leading to Christ, leading to the church, leading to the promise we have and the rest we have spiritually. We talk about in songs we sing, Canaan's land, I'm on my way, where the soul never dies, that song, and that's talking about heaven, our Canaan land. And also, if they were obedient under that law, they have the promise of heaven, or the hope of heaven through Christ as well. But we see that in the comparison. Here's a land of rest, and you don't enter because of unbelief. You fell away, you departed, you were disobedient, and now you don't get to enter in. And he's comparing that with what's going to happen if they fall away, if they continue to be in unbelief and unfaithful to God. And that's why he says, beware, brethren, in verse 12. So after he gives this excerpt and this example, it says, beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God, but exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. So he says, beware, basically watch out. We got to be vigilant. And the devil walks about like a roaring lion, and it's constant vigilance. It's being watchful all the time. We can't let down our guard, and we have to humble ourselves knowing that we are just as likely to fall away if we don't, if we aren't diligent in our work to the Lord. And so he says, beware. This is, it's kind of sinister seeing here that there is a possibility of falling away. Here's this land of rest we're promised. Beware lest you don't get it. Beware lest you don't enter in. And it says in chapter 4 and verse 1, since a promise remains of entering his rest, let us fear lest any of you seem to have come short of it. So it's something that needs to be in our lives, a fear, because it keeps us watchful. Fear is a healthy thing when it's in the right position. When we are fearing falling away, when we are fearing disobeying God and letting him down, then we're going to be more watchful. And to speed, that's what diligent means, to do good and to obey him. And so beware, you're not exempt from this possibility of falling away. It says that lest there be an evil heart of unbelief. What's unbelief mean? Because they obviously believed in God. So what does unbelief mean?
Didn't believe enough to take action. I mean, that there's tacit, it was just a tacit belief, not actual belief that leads to action.
Okay. Do what?
Not trusting.
Right. There's a question here on the sheet, and not everyone has it. But in question 5 says, consider how belief and obedience are correlated in verses 18 and 19. We're not there yet, but there's a correlation between belief or unbelief and disobedience and belief and obedience. When we talk about faith, that word, that Greek word, pistis, it means belief. It means a personal conviction of something. You have, you're persuaded to believe something. You see something, you believe it. You hear something, you believe it. You have faith in it. And so belief, the definition of that Greek word, is not necessarily the faith that saves us. Because faith that saves us is coupled with obedience. And without that, it's a dead faith, as we see in James chapter 2. And so we see they had an evil heart of unbelief. And that's where we get to Romans, the first chapter. And there's a good example of this, that people had faith and that they believed. They had a belief, but they didn't have the faith that saves. When we see in Hebrews 11 and verse 6, it says, without faith it is impossible to please him, because you have to know that he is, and he's a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. So that faith that saves is those the one that you believe in him and that you diligently seek him. He's going to reward you. But in Romans 1 and verse 20 is an example of this being in unbelief, an evil heart of unbelief. It says, since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse, because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals, creeping things. Therefore, God gave them up to an uncleanness and the lust of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. So we see they knew God. There was without excuse. There's no doubt there is a God, but they didn't obey him through unbelief and evil heart, because they wanted to indulge in the flesh and the lust of the flesh, eyes, and pride of life. And so the actual definition of that Greek word, pistis, which is belief, it's persuasion, a conviction of something, is not the faith that saves. Because the faith that saves is not only that belief and conviction, but it's an obedience with that. It's seeing God, knowing that He is, and subjecting yourself to everything He has to give us. And when it talks about the faith that saves, it's not just saying mere belief, because even the demons have faith. They believe and tremble. But it's talking about the whole encompassing factor of faith and obedience. They're both linked together. Without faith, you can't please God. Without obedience, you can't please God. And so we go to Hebrews, the 11th chapter in verse 1. And often we refer to this as the divine definition of faith. It's part of the divine definition of faith. That is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. This is what is included in faith. This is what faith is part of. This is part of what faith is. But then you even go to the 6th verse and that I just talked about. And it says, without faith, it is impossible to please Him. For he who comes to God must believe that He is, and He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. And throughout that entire chapter, it gives examples of people who believed Him, knew He was there, knew He was great and almighty God, and believed that He would reward them, and then they had to diligently seek Him to consummate their faith, to make their faith that saving faith. And that's what James 2 is talking about, a saving faith. It's not talking about... I heard someone say, and I read on the internet once, a man making the argument that the faith or faith without works is dead, or faith alone can't save. It's talking about dead faith. So dead faith alone can't save. Well, that means something coupled with dead faith can save. And that doesn't make any sense. So he really just put his foot in his mouth. What it's talking about is faith coupled with works is a consummation of what pleases God. We have to have both in order to please Him. And so their unbelief is not a lack of conviction that God exists, that He's all-powerful, and that He is the one true God. It's their lack of obedience coupled with that conviction. And that's what it means when it's talking about unbelief. Any comments or questions about that? Does that make sense?
The next verse pretty well explains it. Because right. That's why you have to exhort and help your brethren along, so they won't fall into that unbelief state.
Right. Exactly. It talks about having an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. And so departing from God, as we talked about in the first four verses of chapter 1 and chapter 3 and verse 6 and chapter 4 and verse 1 and so on and so forth, and departing from the faith, apostatizing, that is showing unbelief, a lack of obedience coupled with this belief. And that's the faith that saves. And certainly that's why we need to exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. So we have to warn one another. We have to encourage one another. We have to edify one another so we know and have a knowledge of these things, so we can know what to look out for, so we can know when we are departing from the faith and when someone is departing from the faith, warn them about it, talk to them about it. We have a responsibility of doing this. And when we think about the problem of forsaking the assembly and not coming to Bible studies and all this stuff, and we get wrapped up in the fact that we can't say, you have to come on this time because we're commanded to meet on the first day of the week. And I understand saying that, but the concept here in chapter 10 and verse 24 is let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works. And how do you do that? What's part of doing that? It's not forsaking the assembling of ourselves, which is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much more as you see the day approaching. So that's part of the exhortation toward one another. That's part of a duty of a Christian. We have times we are meeting together, and if you're not showing up to exhort one another, considering one another to stir up love and good works, and you're not showing up because we're not commanded to do so specifically on that day and time, then you're still failing to obey a commandment to exhort one another. And it's necessary because we have the danger of falling away. And because there's that danger of falling away through an evil heart of unbelief, we have to exhort one another. It says, does that make sense? Any questions or comments about that? I know that's a touchy issue, and we won't dwell on that right now. We'll talk about it more in chapter 10, probably. We see it says, while it is called today, and he quotes that from the 95th Psalm in verse 7 here in Hebrews 3, today if you will hear his voice. So exhort one another daily while it is called today. What significance does that bring? Why does he even bring up that word today? Is it talking about any specific day?
Just promise
not promise tomorrow. That's a very good way of looking at it. Our life is but a vapor. Do it now. Do it every day. When you have the chance to exhort one another, when you have a chance to grow closer to God, when you have a chance to repent and make your lives right with God, you do it today, because you don't have a promise of the next day. We don't see tomorrow as a promise and a sure thing. So do it today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. Who's a great example we can see of the deceitfulness of sin? And what does that mean, deceitfulness of sin? Sin looks pretty good to us, right? It is deceiving.
David? He got wrapped up in
right.
Deceitfulness of sin. It was good.
Everyone is deceived to some extent. Do what? Adam and Eve. That's what I was thinking of. The very first time we see this deception. This looks good. It looks good to eat. That he doesn't want you to eat it because you're going to be like him. Well, being like him, he's God. God is good. Okay, it sounds good. It looks good. I'm going to have all this knowledge. It looks good to eat. And then she eats it and it has a negative consequence. Sin always has a negative consequence. There's no sin that doesn't have a negative consequence. And we see it time and again in the examples given to us, recorded in the Bible and even in our own lives. We sin, something bad happens. And always the thing that happens that's bad is that we're not in fellowship with God anymore. He can't be in fellowship with darkness, because he is light, and in him is no darkness at all. And so that deception of sin is going to harden your hearts. And we talk about hardening our hearts. We know his commandments, we know his wills, but we want to do something else because it looks better. And that's deceiving. It's not true. It isn't better. Serving him is always the best thing you can do, the only thing you should do. And Colossians 2 and verse 4 talks about deceiving with persuasive words of human wisdom, deceiving with philosophy, people deceiving you into thinking we should do certain things, deceiving yourself thinking that asceticism is wise and will help you get to heaven. No, it has an appearance of wisdom, but there's no wisdom there. And it's the same with all the false doctrines that can deceive us. Beware of false prophets, lest they bring you away. And in Matthew chapter 7, and they're disguised as sheep and they're actually wolves, and they're deceiving you. That's the whole purpose of that. Sin is deceiving. It has an appearance of something good, but it's not. And because of that, we can harden our hearts thinking it is better, or choosing it because it seems better at the time. And so beware lest this happen. Today, exhort one another. Get it done with, and always be aware and have constant vigilance. For we have become, in verse 14, partakers of Christ, if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end, while it is said, today, if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts, as in the day of rebellion. We have become partakers of Christ. What does that mean? What did Christ do? What does it mean to be a partaker of him? And we talked about in chapter 2, what did Christ accomplish that allows us to accomplish that same thing? Because he did it first and he showed us the way. He died, he suffered, he's able to sympathize with us, and he overcame death. He was resurrected, he overcame death, and we can overcome death as well through him. We are partakers of him, and through him we have the promise. He entered the most holy place. We can enter the most holy place because he opened it up for us. He made that sacrifice that allows us to do this. And we are the priests according to him. We are a holy priesthood, a holy nation, a royal priesthood. And so through him, partaking through him, we can take hold of this. It says, if, there we have that same word again, as in verse 6, that if we hold fast the confidence of rejoicing with hope firm to the end. And in verse 14 it says, if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end. So you can only accomplish what Christ did through him if you hold fast your confidence, the beginning of your confidence. What does that What is that referring to? The beginning of our confidence. And keep in mind, these are Hebrew Christians. So under an old law, subject to the old law, they think this is what it's all about. And now they have a beginning of a confidence of what? Something better. The better covenant. They heard of Christ, God's Son, and how much better all that seemed. And now they're fading away from that. It doesn't seem as good as it used to. And they're falling back to this, being deceived by sin. And so the beginning of our confidence. We go back to chapter 1 and or chapter 2 in verses 3 through 4. It says, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? So here you got the old law, but now you've got this new law that gives you a hope of so great a salvation. And now you're neglecting this. That's the beginning of their confidence. They knew it was great. They were happy about it, excited about it, and all of a sudden now they're starting to fade away. And that's why he's writing them this epistle. So that's the beginning of our confidence. Said, hold it steadfast to the end. Be faithful unto death, I will give you the crown of life. Revelation 2:10. What that means is not only the end of your life, you grow old and you fall and you die, but it's talking about being faithful to death, to the point of death through persecution. To the end, no matter which way the end comes, you're faithful to the end and he'll give you the crown of life. And so we have to be faithful even under persecution. And he says again, today, if you will hear his voice, we have to hear his voice. Faith comes by hearing, hearing by the word of God. But don't harden your hearts in hearing this, as in the days of rebellion when the Israelites did this. Any comments or questions? We have a few minutes left and we'll be able to finish. So in verse 16, he starts asking some questions and he answers them with questions. He says, Who having heard rebelled? Indeed, was it not all who came out of Egypt led by Moses? Now with whom he was angry for 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose corpses fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear by that they would not enter his rest, but to those who did not obey? So we see that they could not enter in because of unbelief. So, who rebelled? It was the people that were delivered from Egyptian bondage. And then he puts in that they were led by Moses. And we go back to the first six verses talking about the superiority of Christ over Moses. Christ was a servant, Moses was a servant. Christ was the Son. He made these things. He wasn't just a mere servant of the household. He was the ruler, sitting at the right hand of God, crowned with glory and honor. And so he shows that again. These people were being led by this great leader that you're falling back into and looking at him instead of Christ. And they failed under him. You're going to fail looking back to him unless you turn to Christ and look to him. So there's some significance in that, that they were led by Moses. It says, who was he angry with for 40 years? And we see that it was those who sinned, whose corpses fell in the wilderness. When we talk about that, God's wrath came upon them and he said, you're not going to enter in, you're going to die in the wilderness. They don't get to enter in that promised land. And the same is with Moses. And that shows significance of God not showing partiality. Moses, a great servant, faithful. And when you think about it, you kind of feel sorry for Moses in a way because he just had a family member that died, I believe it was Miriam, I think was the name of the woman. And we have that happening to him at the end. He's been putting up with these complaining Israelites. They're seeing the works of God. They're seeing him providing for them all these miracles and leading them out of bondage of Egypt and complaining. Moses is having to put up with it. And then he makes one simple mistake, it seems like. He strikes the rock instead of speaking to it. And all of a sudden, he's been waiting this whole time. And he's come back around to a full circle. They saw it. They didn't enter in because of unbelief. They didn't think they would be able to come all the way back again. Moses strikes the rock, he can't enter in. And you kind of feel for the guy, but he made a mistake. He fell short of obeying the commandments of God. And that's all it takes for us, too. We talk about how, oh, I'm righteous, I'm good, I'm going to make it to heaven. You know, I'm doing everything right. And then you're not vigilant anymore because you think you've got it made. Paul says, I have not attained yet. I press on. I keep pressing on toward that goal, the prize of the upward call of God. And so we have to keep that diligence and perseverance through these things. So they fell in the wilderness. Whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who did not obey? And here's that question on this sheet, consider how belief and obedience are correlated in verses 18 and 19 compared to Hebrews 11 and James 2, 14 through 26. So what's the correlation there? What do we say about belief or and obedience?
It's necessary.
It's necessary. Belief without works is dead. And the same with works without belief. They're together. You can't have one without the other and expect anything good. They both come together in that. So there's that correlation there. That they didn't obey, those were the ones that were not able to enter in. And then verse 19 it says that they weren't able to enter in because of unbelief. And that's not a contradiction. You said they weren't able to enter in because of this, and you weren't able to enter in because of this. He's saying that both of those mean the same thing in a way. That unbelief is that having faith without works, or not having faith at all, and the same thing with works without faith. And so the answer to all those questions were the Israelites. He's showing the contrast between the old law and the new law, and that this new law is better, and you've fallen away from it, and you're going to not be able to enter in the promised land, the land of rest. God rested on that seventh day. We work until we get there. And if you stop working, if you turn back to something else, then you're going to be just like the Israelites. They weren't able to enter in. You're not going to be able to enter in. So we see in chapter 4, he's going to get further into this. He's going to start talking about it even more. That since a promise remains of entering his rest, let us fear, lest any of you seem to have come short of it. Any other comments or questions?
On the Moses thing?
Yes.
No, I know he made a mistake. I don't know. From what I remember of the story, it was kind of more than just making a mistake. It was like Moses actually was taking, shall I bring forth you water?
Right.
He was seemed to be taking credit for it. Again, on top of that, then he smoked the rod out. I think he just did it on purpose. I don't know that he forgot or
right.
Mistake. It seemed like he just did it on purpose. But I think the main thing there was that he was trying to take, the way his story reads, it sounded like he was trying to take credit for it instead of giving God credit. Shall I do this for you people? And
right.
Whack.
Yeah, there were several things wrong with that. And the basis is that he disobeyed. And even though that was this one time, and you're right there at the promised land of Canaan, and now you can't enter in because you disobeyed me. And like we said before, he was told to strike the rock, and he struck the rock. Maybe he was caught up in the moment and thought he was supposed to strike the rock, or like Randy said, I could see that he was taking it upon himself, acting like he had the power or he had the ability, and he was doing it for them as opposed to God. But we see they didn't enter in because of unbelief, and that includes Moses not able to enter in that physical land of Canaan.
Another would have been a good person, but maybe not thinking and just did it.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
That would have been a good example. Someone being killed.
Right.
He just made a mistake, not thinking.
God means business, and ignorance isn't an excuse. He'll judge everyone. Good point. Anything else? All right, we'll get into chapter 4. I don't know about next week, but at least the week after that. And I've got the handouts here if you need any of them. So thank you for your time.